are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, October 5th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, but instead from sunny Las Vegas, Nevada, where I haven't seen the sun in days because I've been inside the Bellagio Hotel Conference Center at the MassTorts 2018 conference. Yes, folks, the biannual visit to Las Vegas to sit down with some tort lawyers, hear about some of the most recent cases that are taking place around the country, involving very often enormous amounts of corporate malfeasance. And today is no different. I am here for this conference. Done a couple of pre-records yesterday because we had trouble scheduling for today. Later on the program, an attorney named Mike Berg, who has been on this program before, to talk about the explosions that took place in Massachusetts from the underground gas pipelines and litigation that I think that's going to, or actions are going to be brought against the company. I think it's National Grid. I can't recall. Then I sat down with Bobby Kennedy yesterday to talk about a case that he was working on as an attorney out of his firm in California against Monsanto, and a large settlement that was given as a function of in regards to Roundup. And I should just tell you right now, we did not talk about vaccinations. I've addressed this in the past with Bobby Kennedy on air, and I've spoken about it on air. I've spoken to him about it on air in the past. We have a fundamental disagreement about his, I wouldn't call him an anti-vaxxer, but I would call him very vax skeptical. And I think that's really an incredibly dangerous position to have, contrary to the science. But you can go back and find that. I think I can't remember exactly when we had that conversation, but we did not get into that at all because I was more interested in that Monsanto thing, and that's what I'm here for, to hear about these cases. Interesting. I figured I'd use an off-label usage for Roundup. So that's a little hint. Just a little bit of house cleaning, and before we get to our first guest, who is also here doing his show from this conference, David Pakman will be joining me in a moment. But before he does, a couple of moments of house cleaning. It's been now publicly announced, when I go to Politicon, I will be debating Charlie Kirk. He is the titular head of Turning Points USA. So, I mean, some people on Twitter have noticed, like, some flunkies from Turning Points have been randomly saying, like, Sam Steeder, I just listened to him for 7 minutes and I could never get those minutes back. Well, yeah, it's true. They will never get them back. And I will continue to take from every single person involved with Turning Points USA. I will take. And so that will be Sunday the 20th or 21st or something like that in L.A. I assume they're going to put it online at one point. I'm not sure. But I'll have more to say about that later. Before we get into this, and I think, David Pakman knows as well as anybody that about the need for a service like News Voice. News Voice is one of today's sponsors. And you can go to newsvoice.com/majority. I think everybody understands the problems with media concentration and the idea of epistemological bubbles that we find ourselves in. I think I used that properly. And it is highly relevant to know what the other side is saying, what conservative thought is. And you don't even have to look at it as the other side. It's just simply getting different perspectives than your own. That's the thing that's good about News Voice. It's a new media company that's come up with their own response to that problem of our blinders and our sort of like predestined algorithms that send us news. It's called News Voice. It's an app for iOS and Android. It gives you access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. And it gives you a personalized news feed that you set up by aggregating a mix of mainstream media news sources, international news sources, independent media sources, and then multiple sources are provided for each news story, as well as left and right you can choose. The entire app is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the app, or you can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be completely open and democratized news aggregator that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You can go download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. I put the link under this video if you're watching on video. And if you're not, you're listening, we've put the link in the description of the podcast. So you can check it out. It's newsvoice.com/majority. Joining me now in the, I don't know what they call this room, the expo room or whatever it is, David Pakman of the David Pakman Show, here to help me, before we get into a couple of those interviews with lawyers, talk about the state of play, obviously the big story of the week, maybe of the month, maybe of the year, aside, of course, from the election that's happening in a month. Brett Kavanaugh's nomination coming down to the wire tomorrow.
51 votes to move forward, have 30 hours of debate, maybe as early as Saturday, they'll have the final vote. Collins, Senator Collins from Maine, scheduled to make a statement at 3 p.m.
Eastern
time, yeah. So that's 3 hours from now.
Yeah, I guess that's 3 hours from now.
And initially reported that she's just going to announce why she's just utterly satisfied with this investigation that's taken place. And even though she had her hesitations initially, she is ready to say, hey, you know what? We did the investigation, and now there's no further reason to hold up Brett Kavanaugh. But a few reporters, including Manu Raju from CNN, said it's not clear that that's what she's going to announce at 3 Eastern. And that would conceivably make a difference. And the 51 votes to move forward on the last 30 hours of debate, Manchin, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, was the one Democrat to say, yes, let's do it. And Lisa Murkowski from Alaska was the one Republican to say, no, let's not go forward. So this actually, I mean, you know, there's sort of like two narratives, right? One is take the 30,000-foot view only, which is it doesn't matter what Susan Collins says on Tuesday. It doesn't matter whether Lisa Murkowski says let's move on to the final debate or not, that they're going to push him through. That was always the plan, and that McConnell knew it, and that even Jeff Flake arguably was part of that plan, going to him and saying, listen, you're not running for re-election. What if you say let's do this investigation? You'll get attention, but we'll still push them through eventually. That's like the 30,000-foot narrative. The micro-narrative is, well, no, if Collins says she's not going to and Manchin says no, then Brett Kavanaugh doesn't get on the court.
Well, a lot of this is going to be resolved in 3 hours.
Yeah.
But and so for many people, by the time they hear this, it'll be moot. But the dynamic one way or another is this, it seems to me. Joe Manchin will not vote for... Joe Manchin will not be the 50th vote. Let's put it this way.
Right.
Because obviously the 51st vote would come from Mike Pence. If Susan Collins announces that she's not going to vote for Kavanaugh, it's very hard for me to believe that Joe Manchin is going
to
be the 50th vote. And
to
then
put
Mike
it to
Pence.
Right.
It's just, I think at that point he can be guaranteed that if he ever needs a single favor from the Democratic caucus, he will not get it. I don't know. It's conceivable that Joe Manchin could decide at one point to become a Republican. I don't know. Like, if he votes, if he's the 50th vote, it seems to me there's going to be some speculation about that.
Because no, but there's already been for years, right?
Right.
I mean, and this
right.
will be, oh, okay, this it seems to be that we were at that point.
This is the move he's going to make.
Yeah.
I don't know why he would do that other than maybe he wants to be in the majority.
Yeah.
And they may offer him something. But I suspect that if Susan Collins comes out and votes no, or she announces that at 3, then Manchin is going to be a no. And the theory would be this. All the senators who vote in this middle ground, right, they're all looking for cover. And so Murkowski, she votes no on cloture. The pressure's off her. No one's looking at her vote. She needed to not just vote against Kavanaugh. She needed to fervently vote against Kavanaugh because I think in a large, the primary impetus is the Native community in Alaska. There's just, she has had strong support from in the past. And because of Kavanaugh's rulings about Indian reservations, they are very nervous about him. And then this, I think on top of that, there's a large amount of sexual assault in the Native community. And I think this is, you know, I think this has become a very important issue for them. So Murkowski, she, all the pressure's off her. Nobody's talking about Murkowski anymore. She has sidelined herself. Collins may want to do the same thing because it will come down to Manchin. And certainly Manchin, Collins, and Murkowski have already talked about what they're going to do. Those three know what each other's plans were.
Isn't it insane, though? And I know that, I mean, this is not like a shock to people who pay attention to politics. It doesn't even figure into any of this what Brett Kavanaugh actually did to women. It's just not a factor. And it never was, right? Like, even from the beginning where Republicans were saying, well, do we or don't we need an investigation? Or who exactly is the right person to ask questions of Christine Blasey Ford? Like, it never actually mattered what Kavanaugh did or didn't do.
I don't think that's true.
Really?
I think Murkowski may have had some issues with voting for Kavanaugh prior to this, but I think Collins would have. I mean, I don't know. Collins still may vote for her, but for him.
But you're saying that her vote would be based on what she genuinely believes happened 30 years ago, or just the political viability of it?
No. I don't think any of them give a crap about what specifically happened one way or another. It is
right.
What do they think is going to, with the public revelations, how is that going to interact with their constituents?
Exactly.
And will it hurt them? And so the Kavanaugh stuff does make a difference one way or another. If it had been, if Blasey Ford had come forward and been far less compelling, I think then Kavanaugh would be fine right now. He still may be ultimately fat, but it had I don't know what Kavanaugh could have done worse, but maybe there. I mean, if there had been another allegation that came out this week that was more prominent, or maybe Mark Judge had said, "Yeah, it's true."
Right.
I think that would have changed things, without a doubt. So, you know, I think these things matter, not because of the way that they influence the politician in their mind and their sentiment. Although I think Heidi Heitkamp, we should note this, it is clear this Kavanaugh thing has hurt her.
Yeah.
And I think for her, largely, it was a personal measure. She may feel that she's going to lose this election anyways, and which makes the decision more about like how she wants to go out. Although I think there's also an argument. It's going to be interesting to see with the Kavanaugh hearing behind her, right? If the Republicans vote against Kavanaugh, if it's ultimately Collins and Murkowski who bring Kavanaugh down, the pressure's off of Heitkamp. If Kavanaugh gets in, the pressure's off of Heitkamp. So I think she's going to have another month to reset the campaign, go back to the issue of health care, which was working for her
yeah.
in South Dakota. So, we'll see.
Do you think Trump has stuck with Kavanaugh because he just wants to win and he sees having to pick somebody else, who he obviously would, as losing? Or do you think it's, I don't know if you've been following the really specific legal reasons why he wants Kavanaugh on the court for what's coming up when it comes to presidential power, when it comes to, there's a case about the sovereignty of the presidency, or like a mix of the two?
I'm sure it's a mix of the two. I think also, it's unlikely, but there's a scenario where they do not confirm Kavanaugh. The midterms happen. Democrats win. And Jeff Flake and Susan Collins say it's not appropriate to confirm somebody in the lame duck session. I think
in the period between the election and January.
Yes, yeah. if the Senate's going to change hands. I think that's a far-fetched
yeah.
scenario, but it's possible. It's possible. I mean, McConnell thinks there's a 10% chance of that happening. It's dangerous, and why I don't want to go there.
But even then, doesn't Trump get his pick after January? Like, will Democrats actually say, I know online people say, if that happens, Democrats should say, we're going to do what you guys did to Garland, but they're not going to do it.
I'm not sure that they wouldn't do that, but they certainly could say that and get a pick that is not on that list of the Heritage Foundation.
That may be.
I mean, the idea that they wouldn't use their leverage at all seems, even for Democrats,
unlikely.
Unlikely. I mean... they still got to win an election, 2 years from January.
Yeah.
At that point, 20 months away. So they're, that would be stunning.
Yeah.
For them to say, we will be the ones to confirm Kavanaugh. I don't think that
that's
will
not
happen.
Happening.
So, I think there's just too many different, who knows why Donald Trump wants this? I think on some level it's also, he doesn't want Kavanaugh to go down for this reason.
Right.
And because this is his core brand proposition.
Do you think that...
Wait, why are you asking me all the questions?
Oh, I don't know. I'm curious what you think.
Well, do you think?
Yeah.
Whatever the question you were going to ask me, ask yourself.
I forgot the question because you threw me off.
Oh, all right.
No, well. I mean, when I think about this entire thing and I think back to the initial, McConnell is either, he's either stumbled into just like a brilliant combination of a chain of events that's going to lead to Kavanaugh getting in, or it was beautifully orchestrated from the beginning where McConnell said from the start, listen, if we slow this down and do an investigation, Democrats will just say it wasn't a sufficient investigation. Of course, then they did a completely insufficient investigation, and now McConnell's able to say, I told you that this is what Democrats were going to say. Like, was it so scripted from the beginning, or did it just end up that way?
No, I think they didn't want to have an investigation.
They genuinely didn't want one.
Right, but it's the obvious thing to say at that point. Democrats will say this because he also knows,
if
we do one, we're not going to do a complete one. I mean, the president can do exactly what he says. We pretend we're doing an event. I mean, the idea of doing an investigation to whitewash anything, not a real investigation, is probably one of the oldest things that politicians,
yeah,
one of their oldest techniques in the world, right?
Right.
I mean, Andrew Cuomo with the Moreland Commission, and then that's what he thought he was getting. And when the Moreland Commission started to actually look into corruption, he's like, well, we're going to have to end this because you guys are not... and this is part of the reason why they wanted to keep it quiet, so that the investigation, they're not going to show the results, so that they can leak things. They did this with, they've done it with different parts of the Russia investigation. This is the way the game is played. But for Collins and Murkowski in particular, they have to be concerned insofar as they can look at the real reports and know how incomplete it is, and then be worried that next week, the Washington Post is going to come out with a story that says X, Y, and Z, and their ability to have said, we saw the FBI investigation, clearly, goes out the window because because they could see that it was incomplete, right? I mean, so the pressure here, there's a certain amount of pressure from just the reality of the situation and what they anticipate are future risks. So
I mean, this is why McConnell just never has to think twice about anything he's doing, because there's just no political risk effectively for any of this stuff for him in Kentucky.
Well, not just in Kentucky. I mean,
or even in his position in the Senate.
Yeah, he has been incredibly successful in jamming the courts with right-wing judges, and I mean, he thinks that history is going to look on his move of keeping that seat open with Garland as the reason why Donald Trump won and led to a fundamental shift in American society because of the courts. And it's hard to argue with that. What also struck me as interesting this week was Brett Kavanaugh yesterday wrote an op-ed.
Yeah, in the Wall Street Journal.
In the Wall Street Journal, where he apologized for how brusque he was.
But said that the reason why that all happened was the allegations.
Yes, yes. I think that was a bow to Jeff Flake, who had said a couple of days ago, we can't have that on the court, that type of... And so they said, go write an op-ed and address this. I mean, I think that's what's happening. We're watching sort of like a PR, you know, crisis management type of situation. And that's what they're doing. And it's like geared towards... I mean, it's sort of sick.
Oh, it's very sick.
It's geared towards one or two people. I mean, that is one of the things that I think has really come out of this, too, is that in addition to the court... hopefully being publicly scarred by this. I mean, I have been very jaded about the Supreme Court for almost exactly 18 and a half years, coming up on almost 19 years with the Bush v. Gore result and ruling. But I think two things come out of this if Kavanaugh is... confirmed. One is the Supreme Court as an institution is been dramatically weakened in the eyes of the American public and ripe for some type of legitimate reform. I think we're going to hear calls for court packing, which in principle I have no problem with. I think
calls from the left.
Calls from the left.
Yeah.
When Democrats return to power, and term limits, which I think are, probably a better reform and more durable long term.
Weren't there people, though, before the 2016 presidential election saying thinking about the future of the Supreme Court isn't a valid thing to think about when you decide who to vote for president? I remember people were saying that.
David Pakman and I went to dinner last night with some... constituencies who felt that. I don't know. Like, Michael has been IMing me, like, get to it already. No, I don't. I mean, look.
Oh, the stuff from last night.
Reveal it from last night. Absolutely.
No.
All personal discussions record.
No.
Hey, David, by the way.
Hey, Michael.
I just think the left needs to be... to start taking the court more seriously.
I think they need to stop being fucking corporate Democrats.
All right. But I think the left needs to start taking the court more seriously, and I think they're going to on some level.
What do you mean when you say the left?
I mean everyone from the center through the entire left.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well... What do you mean by that's not going to happen?
Well, what does it mean to take the court seriously?
What's
actionable about that?
You don't write off considering the impact of what's going to happen on the court when you decide who to vote for.
So here's
which is
my
some people
theory.
Were doing before 2016.
Here's my theory.
But
we vote our fucking conscience. And then there's a filibuster.
All right, well, wait, I want to go through this with Jamie a little
bit. But voting isn't activism. What else could the left be doing?
Oh, well, I think the left could also start being more aware of the issues that the court deals with, so that you don't just have activists who are arguing about a woman's right to choose, which, of course, is hugely important. And I don't want any what I'm saying to in any way imply that we need less of that. We need more of that.
The answer she's looking for is car bombs, Sam.
But no, but I'm saying there should also be a greater awareness about, I mean, when was the last time we heard anything about Citizens United?
Maybe also things like feeders, like
I mean,
the
honestly,
Federalist
like
Society.
When was the last time we heard anybody talk about Citizens United? That died a very quick death. And, or I should say, you know, in terms of like activism around that, or beyond Citizens United, what about things like, you know, the importance of the court in terms of what agencies do, and the even things like the ACA? You can both feel like the ACA did not go far enough, and that there's something fundamentally wrong with the court, because it doesn't say that the government can expand Medicaid.
Don't you think also a strategy for dealing with things like the Federalist Society and long-term plans for how to actually
do that with the ACS. I mean, when Obama, first of all, there should have been more pressure on Obama to make nominations of subsidiary courts. There was none. There was a couple of people writing about it, a couple of people complaining about it, but no one on the left cared. There was no letter writing. There was no petitioning. There was no activism around it at all.
Because Merrick Garland's a corporatist.
And then when people are put up for the court, there's barely a peep. And
even on Janus.
Well, I'm not even talking about the rulings as so much as, like, you know, when you had different very progressive justices who were put up, who were knocked down by the Republicans. There was, you know, nary a peep. And so, you know, electoral politics are not the end all be all. But when it comes time to vote, you should factor that in. And when it comes time to, you know, what's getting you agitated, that should also factor.
There was always the two things for voting for Clinton over Trump, and there were many, but it was really simple. If you wanted to simplify it, you could just say Supreme Court picks and Iran deal. And those are the two things that have already been, I mean, among many, many others, obviously. But those were such clear dividing lines in terms of voting intelligently. And no one has any answers to those two. And they're both catastrophic.
Well, yeah, I don't think most people on the left are arguing against voting for Hillary Clinton. Like, that's not an interesting question to me or most of us, I would think. But the question then becomes,
well, not most people, but all you needed was less than 70,000 people to go out and vote in three states.
But then what else are we supposed to do? Because
okay, I think this is good. I mean, so there's another thing here which is not often discussed. Remember last night there was discussion of 400,000 people protesting, and you got very, very agitated when that was brought up, and civil disobedience and general strikes and so on. There's been this entire plan, right, where if you don't show up to work one day, you're fired because you're at will. Wage is stagnant in real terms for 40 years. So even if you're not going to get fired because you go to do civil disobedience or participate in a general strike, you can't afford to do it. So there's this entire infrastructure where when we say, well, okay, you vote every 2 years or however often, but what else, right? Other than signing petitions and letter writing, the entire infrastructure is set up so that people really just can't go out and do what would be the next things to do.
Well, I mean, the idea of some type of wildcat strike around the Supreme Court, which is so crucial, has been never even contemplated. And yes, I agree. I wouldn't say most of the left, by any means, didn't take voting, you know, for Clinton seriously, but we had an election where she lost by 70,000 votes over the course of three votes. I mean, 7,000 people, was it in Michigan? Or is it 11,000 or 10,000 in Wisconsin? A big part of that had to do with voter suppression. A big part of that voter suppression had to do with the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act.
David.
And, I mean, so the, I mean, just the idea of, like, protests, there should have been protests about the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. There should be people organizing about it. So,
David, how agitated was Sam on a scale of 1 to 10?
I'm having a hard time hearing Michael. What did he ask me?
David, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can.
About how agitated was Sam if you were going to use a 1 to 10 scale?
I mean, he was more agitated than I've maybe ever seen him in person. Or through audiovisual recordings.
The goddamn Supreme Court. But yeah, no, I mean, and the same would go for labor protections. The same would go for, I mean, the only thing that I think is maybe, it's not a validating criticism of the dumb perspective at all. But, you know, Democrats did use the Supreme Court in a non-affirmative way in elections, right? Like, not here's what we might want to do with who we put on the Supreme Court, but simply we will put on people who aren't absolute monsters, which is true and is enough of a reason to vote for them in a general election. Well, look, but maybe, again, there does need to be maybe more of a strategic, proactive vision for what a progressive court could look like, right?
Yes. Well, look, absolutely. And I will say that a certain percentage of the Democrats, I don't know if it's 30% or 35% or 25%, are quite happy for the court to roll back.
Yes.
Consumer protections, worker protections, regulatory schemes, because then they don't have to.
Right.
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 And so,
right.
You know, we had, I don't know how many Democrats voted, maybe a half a dozen voted to roll back Dodd-Frank. And, you know, they can do it because it's quiet and nobody pays that much attention to it. And this is a problem. I mean, and this is a problem because the left is not, and again, by the left, I mean from the center to the far left. And for some of them, that's just not, you know, what their shtick is. But the bottom line is the implications of the Supreme Court are just not appreciated broadly by the left.
I mean,
dumb left is an ad hominem, though. We're not supposed to say that.
I enjoyed saying that.
All right, wait. What did Jamie what?
So I actually talked to my friend who's in the DSA's legal working group the other day, and he listens to the show. I think he's called in before, and he was talking about some of the real structural barriers to setting up a left version of something like the Federalist Society.
Absolutely.
Which is, I mean, he could probably call in and tell you more. But, like, the career path to being even considered to be nominated for a judgeship involves being a prosecutor, which mostly means putting black people in jail. So, right there, no matter how much legal aid you've done on the other side, that is a structural check on how progressive you're going to be as a judge. And, like, there are all kinds of other ways people start out as, you know, progressive young lawyers who want to do right by the world and end up being much more conservative and much more establishment.
Well, I think that's accurate, but the job for the broad left is to also make sure that the apparatus is such that we're not allergic to those people, right? I mean, certainly we have examples of people who are on the left of center, who are prosecutors. You know, three or four of them are sitting on that Judiciary Committee. They exist, certainly, but
I'm talking about probably to the left of that. Like, I don't know.
Well, I understand, but I'm talking about the broad left. I mean, I don't know, you know, the membership of DSA is what now, like 40, 50,000 people,
30,000?
About 50,000.
50 plus.
So, okay, so
it's going to need to coalition with other people, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And, and there just has to be a bigger awareness of the importance of the courts, and there isn't. And I know that...
Well, maybe there would be if you and David didn't smear fucking Tulsi Gabbard.
Well, I think one advantage to being...
So we could go to war with fucking Syria. And that's the whole point. The fucking corporate Democrats, they say, don't vote your conscience. And then we have fucking war, and Tucker Carlson said so.
It does seem like we actually are starting to gear up for... Mattis, this week, I think it was, announced a greater military presence in Syria.
Absolutely.
Exactly, and here's a clip of Hillary Clinton saying something in 2010. That's the whole fucking point.
Well, yeah. I do think the anti-capitalist left has to draw the line somewhere, right? Like, the DSA engages in targeted electoral campaigns. We do not issue blanket endorsements for all Democrats, right? Like,
how does that connect, though?
Some Democrats, going back to the voting and the being aware of who's going to be president.
I'm not saying the DSA needs to make endorsements of Democrats. That's not at all what I'm saying.
Okay, because I think people
I'm saying
sometimes
the broader left needs to have a greater awareness of the importance of courts. And
no, I agree with you.
Anybody defensive. That should not make you defensive about saying, of justifying what the DSA position is about endorsements. I am not talking about just 50,000 people. I mean, I'm talking about the, you know, tens of millions of people who, you know, engage in politics in some measure or another. There's a broad responsibility to understand the implications of the courts. And certainly, I get very agitated, as I may have at dinner last night, with people who just casually dismiss the relevance of the courts and focus on other things, like, you know, the curve of a smile when you talk about Medicare or something like that.
Oh, no,
like,
I absolutely agree with you.
You see how Kamala Harris is nodding her head here? Isn't that super fucking corporatist?
I agree with you about that. I just think it's important to make it clear that when you say that, you're not saying that what that means is that the left should just focus on getting Democrats elected above all else.
It's not above all else. It's above very specific other things, right? Like, it's contextual to some degree.
Of course.
It's above some incredibly stupid arguments that people are still trotting out to build their own delusional personal brands.
Okay,
that,
but
right.
can
it
you
has,
see...
That's not, it has nothing to do with what you're talking
can you
about.
Can you see how people might take that the wrong way, though?
I mean, but I that's on them to research.
We know some of those people.
Right. Yeah, we know those people. They're having it the wrong way right now, I'm sure.
I'm not saying... I'm not saying don't weigh anything else. I am saying that there has been a complete undervaluing of the court in our society. Right. And that is highly problematic. And I think, you know, the argument's going to be, you know, clearer when either Kavanaugh or if it ends up being, was it Wendy Barrett or whatever her name is, ends up on the court. And maybe people will start to be able to connect, like, oh, here's why public sector unions have been devastated. Oh, here's why there's no bank regulation.
Or maybe
here's
potentially...
Here's why the air is significantly more polluted than it was 5 years ago.
Or to interject, Sam, maybe even more so, really dangerously, is let's play a positive scenario. Bernie Sanders elected president, there's some type of this, and that would be far more beyond electoral for those things to happen. There would need to be the type of, you know, broad mobilization. And then Medicare for all, okay, in this scenario, it's passed. A Kavanaugh-Roberts court is striking that down. There's no doubt that an actual left agenda that was passed in Congress and mobilized for in street action would run full stop against an oligarchic Supreme Court. So even in these much more idealistic fantasy scenarios,
forget about Bernie Sanders. When President Ocasio-Cortez is inaugurated 20 years from now, and she moves to to go to a perfect single-payer situation, to nationalize the banks, to, you know, expropriate the oil refineries. And the court goes, ha, no.
Right.
I mean, this will be the same court.
And this happens, that we actually can see examples of this, of those, you know, agendas conflicting in other countries. So I think, and again, I feel like what also frustrates me is what you guys are saying, certainly what I'm saying, is pay more attention to the court includes have term limits on the court, potentially
right.
pack the court, make it much right. more democratically accountable and transparent.
Right.
That's
right.
part of
I
the
mean,
point.
I think, I think part of it is now is like understanding the importance of the court would lead... you'd see activism and agitation about term limits,
right.
or about, you know, packing the court. Like I say, not my preferred reform. It's not really reform, but I think it would be very helpful to have a very large movement in this country saying pack the courts, where, you know, an 80-year term limit ends up being the compromise position. I think that's super important. You know, on Monday... depending on my babysitter situation, because the kids are out of school, we may run the an interview I did with Carol Anderson,
right.
and
on voting rights,
on voting rights. But really, the interview ended up, you know, because she wrote that book about white rage, and which was all about black people in this country getting some measure of rights, and then white people pushing back institutionally, and, you know, maybe two steps forward, one and a half steps back type of situation.
And
then, the parallels between what the court did back then, and by back then I mean pre-Jim Crow, Jim Crow and post, again, sort of like mid-Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, through to the 60s.
Right.
Like, this regime lasted for 70 years.
Right.
A regime of voter suppression lasted 70 years. And so I don't know that people, you know, like, fully appreciate, like, you know, the era that we could be entering into.
Yeah, but Ocasio-Cortez endorsed Andrew Cuomo, which shows you it's fucking corporations, and that's why they want war with fucking Syria. And Tucker Carlson is the only one that says Amazon is bad because you're fucking neoliberal sellouts.
All right. You need a palate cleanser.
Well, look.
I actually am really enjoying this.
We can do all of those things, right? Like, we need a diversity of tactics and a separation of... Oh, that's a bad analogy I'm not going to make. But, like, the people on the progressive left liberals, social democrats, absolutely should be doing more activism around the judiciary. The people on the far left should be doing street actions around it. And we have been. So I think those things can all go together.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm in no way making an indictment of the far left in this. I keep saying over and over again, from the center through the entire left.
And the indictment is of the dumb left, which, if you guys don't want to do it, ad hominems. Or just dumb. Just dumb.
It's not just the dumb left. It is also... There's a lot more people, frankly, in the center to the, you know, who identify as liberals.
Right.
Who, again, do not appreciate the implications of the court. I mean, this is a problem. And I don't know how else to articulate this other than keep saying the center throughout the entire left.
The fucking center.
It's especially a problem relative to the focus the right has on it, right? Like, if the right,
this is the important
point. If the right knows what the left doesn't about it, and that's the problem.
Yes. And that's, I mean,
they subordinated everything to that. Some of them really were sincerely like, Donald Trump is a repulsive, disgusting human being, and there's one reason to vote in November. The court.
And that
while Democrats were running and center to left, whatever terms, were running around in circles thinking about nonsense.
And that power strategy is undeniable for them.
Yes.
Yes, and they win that way. And that's what matters, winning.
Yeah, I agree.
I think David Pakman has had about four words that you've been able to say during the course of this.
And
well,
two
he was
were
asking
dumb.
Questions.
He's just asking questions.
He's just asking questions.
No, listen,
questions.
You have got a ton of people in that studio.
We roll deep at the Majority Report.
We didn't even give Brendan a microphone.
Brendan.
Oh, he's got one.
Yeah, I have one. There's been a lot of good points that I share, so I didn't want to inundate David with all these other people.
I mean, saw people packing Grand Central Station the other night. Sorry, I'll let you talk. There've been a lot of protests.
But like, I mean, cool. But so what? It's great, but it doesn't matter.
I think people. Just saying, people are getting more activated around this issue, and you're going to continue to see it.
I hope so. I
mean, it's been a pleasure being with you. And no, listen, Politicon. I mean, Politicon.
Oh yeah, I guess we should talk about that. What are you doing at Politicon?
I have no idea.
You have no idea.
I think I'm on any time that there's like something huge going on. Like for example, when Cenk is debating Tucker Carlson. That's when I'll be scheduled to do a really obscure 6-person panel in the basement of the building. So that's my schedule for Politicon. And I honestly still don't even know what I'm doing.
You should do a segment on how to be a fucking sellout.
Oh my God.
I think every panel is essentially that, according to some people.
You got to hear
you
the Bill Clinton.
You guys are on a panel together, actually.
Oh, yeah? What's the panel?
Should we be socialists?
Is that actually happening?
That sounds fun.
It's on the schedule.
I think so.
Mm. You know, they have no socialists on that panel. I was texting with Kyle Kalinske, and so I think that was slated to be me, Kyle Kalinske, Anna Kasparian, Bakari Sellers, and I think that's it, the four of us, and you're moderating.
Yeah.
And so Kyle said, well, my view is basically your view. I'm a social democrat. And I said, oh, okay, is Anna a socialist? He goes, no. And I'm like, okay, well, Bakari Sellers is definitely not. So they're doing a panel on socialism with no socialists.
Right. I got to be honest. I don't take Politicon seriously.
Okay.
I'm
really?
Not going to lie.
I didn't realize that.
I am excited to debate Charlie Kirk.
Right.
And if I have to go and sit on a panel.
Or moderate one.
Fine. That's great.
Yeah, Sam, you got to get ready for President Pence, too.
Yes. I'm doing a panel on Vice President Pence.
Oh, really?
Becoming president.
I have no idea. Oh. I don't take it seriously.
Ann Coulter?
I don't know. I just, you know, I'm assuming they're going to give us lunch.
I am not assuming that.
Well, as long as I get lunch.
They're not going to give you lunch? Jesus.
I've seen nothing about lunch.
This has to be lunch.
Okay. Now
we're taking a very Jewish turn in the conversation.
Assuming that there is lunch, you can tell them I'm available if they want a real socialist.
Yes, they don't. They don't care. Yeah. They don't care about any of it.
The socialism panel definitely doesn't have lunch. I thought you meant like in general, like they might give you lunch.
No, I just...
Can we have nosh while we talk about socialism?
All right. I just don't care about it. No one's... It doesn't implicate anything.
We got to cut this up.
Sam, do you want to hear the copy?
Can we cut this up into
President
a promo?
Pence?
I don't care about it.
No, I don't even want to hear the copy.
Come to Politicon.
It's pretty bad.
No.
2018.
I would go to see me debate Charlie Kirk.
Right.
Right.
That's going to be fun. The panels, you know, if
Less
people
fun.
Don't go to the panels, then, you know.
And that debate's not scheduled to be, like, in the second kitchen for the custodial staff of the building. They're doing it in, like, a legitimate room for you.
Wow.
I don't know the details,
okay.
But
I would ask.
I mean, as long as there's video of it, I just sit in a room. I'll take Charlie Kirk to dinner. And someone's videotaping. I should say Pac-Man was videotaping last night, and I told him he cannot release that. Highly inappropriate at
David,
the middle of a liquid
David, hit me on the side.
I'll send you the video, Sam, and you can make the call.
No,
as to,
it's just not appropriate.
It's not appropriate to watch me terrorizing a table about the Supreme Court.
The restaurant had started clearing out by that.
I just want to hit on a couple of points.
Yeah.
How much have you dug into this supposed NAFTA reform?
Some.
Your sense?
Well, it's definitely no longer called NAFTA.
That's correct.
Yeah, but there's some tweaks, you know, like 62.5% of car components used to have to be made in the three countries to avoid tariffs. That's now 75% in the USMCA. Is that a brand new deal? Like, if NAFTA was the worst deal ever, does going from 62.5% to 75%, is that mind-blowingly different? Not really. You know, there's intellectual property stuff where copyright will persist 70 years beyond the life of the copyright holder versus 50. I don't know that that's even the right direction.
No, that's the wrong direction. Right,
exactly.
Without a doubt, increasing that is bad for consumers, for artists, for everybody.
Public health has implications for pharmaceuticals.
Public health. Yes. One of Trump's complaints with TPP was that the conflicts between the parties were going to be adjudicated in this kind of transnational, extrajudicial whatever.
Right. This is the corporate resolution ID.
Yes,
I can't remember exactly.
That's basically, like, another version of that is how the three countries, U.S., Mexico, and Canada, you know, Trump complained NAFTA doesn't allow for holding anybody accountable if they violate the agreement. The way that now it can be done would be through basically the same type of board that TPP would have put in place, which I thought Trump was against. You know, I mean, it's a gong show.
Right, and to the extent that there was any of those other changes in terms of, like, the car stuff, that was all part of the TPP.
Well, yes, right.
That had been negotiated with Canada and Mexico as part of the TPP.
Yeah.
And that was just language that was lifted from there.
Yep.
There is actually some enhanced labor protections for
the
Mexico.
$16 an hour thing, right?
Yeah. Right.
And I think, and Zach Carter, we did the illicit history of trade for my show, and what he said is, you know, there are some people inside the Trump administration which specifically on issues like that are considering some relatively, you know, leftward moves. And the reason literally is, you know, a white ethno state. But it's the soft side of the cruelty and racism of immigration policy. It's the, like, if labor is less exploited and less abused in Mexico, there's less incentive to come here. So it's okay. I mean, it's the right policy for the most obscene reasons imaginable. But it is an interesting policy shift.
Yeah.
All right. Well, David, we've got to get to a couple of the lawyer interviews that I did.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We didn't have a chance to talk about how the Trump administration wants to weaken mercury regulations. But who doesn't want a little extra mercury?
Here's a clip of Bakari Sellers talking about mercury in 2010. Maybe you could just smear Tulsi Gabbard more. Fucking sellout.
All right. Look, let's take a quick break. And then run this interview with Mike Berg, who talks about the explosions in Massachusetts. And then we will come back and throw to the Bobby Kennedy interview. David Pakman, DavidPakmanShow.com.
Right. DavidPakman.com.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Scoring that URL. All right, DavidPakman.com. Obviously, you can find him on YouTube, youtube.com/TheDavidPakmanShow. The David Pakman Show. Congratulations on that one.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break, and we'll be right back with Mike Berg. Sitting with me now at the Mass Torts Conference 2018, Nevada, Las Vegas, Mike Berg from the law firm
Berg Simpson, Eldridge, Hirsch, and Jardine.
And Mike, you and I have talked in the past. You've done a lot of, I know, construction litigation, faulty.
Mass Torp, been the lead lawyer in the Yaz and the Ortho Ever and the Zyprexa litigation, Pradaxa.
Okay, so what are you working on now?
I think there's something that people should really know about that we're working on now. You know, with the Kavanaugh hearing and the hurricane, the very little news came out about these gas explosions that occurred north of Boston in the Lawrence and Andover area. These explosions were not one explosion of one building. These were explosions of multiple buildings along the main and feeder lines of the gas company, Columbia Gas. It's the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. I've tried numerous gas explosion cases around the country, have handled more than 50 gas explosions. This is the worst conduct I've ever seen by a gas company.
What? Okay, give us a sense of, and I don't think people appreciate this. This is, when you say it went across these two towns, it wasn't where they were joining. I mean, it literally, like, how many miles span were houses subjected to just blowing up?
Probably between 3 and 5 miles. for so long. It's unbelievable. And the reason, and this is really such an amazing situation, is in 2004, the gas company got acquired. At that time, we have memos showing that they knew that these lines, these old steel lines, which had been around for more than 50 years, needed to be replaced. They had leaks, they had corrosion, and they knew they were dancing with the devil if they didn't do it.
And so this is Columbia Energy, and they are bought out by National Grid. Is that what happened?
Well, they were bought out by a company out of Ohio, which bought them. Is a holding company that now owns Columbia Gas, but we hold both responsible. And they knew in memos that they needed to repair and replace these lines. They knew there were leaks in these lines. They knew that if they didn't do it and didn't do it really quickly, there were going to be potential problems. And what people don't understand about the delivery of natural gas is that it's lighter than air. So if you have leaks, what happens to it, it tries to get above ground. It'll go ahead and permeate along the line. And if you have multiple leaks along the line, which is what they had here, ultimately that gas will find a way to get out, whether it's through cracks in the basement, whether it's in a house, whether it's in a store. And when it does, and you get the right mixture of oxygen and natural gas, and it can be from a pilot light, it can be from a boiler, it can be from static electricity, you now have an ignition source, and the next thing you know, you have a catastrophic explosion, which there's deaths, there's people who are burned.
How many deaths were we talking about?
We know of at least three at this point in time. We have probably a half dozen people that have been burned. But even beyond that, these people have been evacuated from their house. And what's interesting is you have the town of Lawrence, which is one of the poorest towns in Massachusetts. And then you have Andover, is one of the richest, right next door. And these poor people, the ones in Lawrence, they were evacuated. They couldn't get back to their home. They have no gas. They have no electricity. They got to go stay with somebody, a friend, outside of the explosion area. Most of them suffer from PTSD. Most of them have incredible damages keeping them from being able to go in and go back to what would be a normal life. Gas still has not been restored.
Wow.
People have still not been able to get to their property.
Well, here's what strikes me. There's a couple of things. Like, and so if I understand you correctly, the gas will leak in one place, and it would just sort of lay across the pipe until it finds a seep that it can go up.
Correct.
And presumably, there were multiple of these over that 3 to 5 mile stretch.
Right.
And then at one point, whatever it was, made it pop up, or they found the gas found one leak that put it to another level, and then they were able to go to the home.
What we do know a couple of things, because we're still in the early stages,
right,
because it just happened within the last 30 days. What we do think is that the gas pressure went down, and then the company increased the gas pressure in the main line.
So the gas pressure goes down because
there's
less gas because of the leaks. They pump up the pressure, which then pushes the pressure on those leaks to find more crevices.
Right, it makes it even worse, because when you have corrosion, I mean, it can happen not only from corrosion, and that's at this point, we have a metallurgist that's looking at it, but we also know, people don't realize, if you have a construction vehicle, a backhoe, or a shovel that just nicks that line, with the freeze-thaw that occurs up in Massachusetts and in other places, you're going to get that steel pipe is going to become brittle. And you may have had, and we don't know yet because we haven't gotten all the information, a catastrophic fracture where the pipe itself breaks open. And maybe there's multiple catastrophic fractures that occurred.
Okay. But clearly that piping, that infrastructure is old.
Yes.
You have memos that suggest that, like, we have old stuff. You guys are buying us, but we should just tell you in full disclosure, we have old stuff. And so the holding company is responsible because they are aware of it. The existing company is responsible. But how do we know 10 miles down the line past Andover,
you know,
or 20 miles west into Worcester. I mean, why are we to believe that any of this stuff is safe?
I don't think there is. I mean, one of the things, I handled a case up in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, in which a whole city block blew up. One of the things, we actually went to trial. One of the things that was very interesting was I was able to ask the people in the gas company, how many more, I said, time bombs, drew an objection. I said, okay, how many more explosions are there under the ground that you don't know about? And the answer is, we don't know. After the case, and we got a very, very large verdict for the injured people in that case, a multi-million-dollar verdict, the jury went to city council and demanded that they replace the entire gas system. And I'm going to tell you, I've talked to the Boston Globe, I've talked to people in Boston, they better be demanding that there's a full and complete looking at the system, as you said, all the way along the line.
Is there a mechanism in the context of the case that you're doing? I mean, chances are you're going to settle, maybe, but who knows? But can that be worked into a settlement or a verdict where it's there's a responsibility to the community?
I think, yes. I think the city council, I know I was interviewed when they were having a city council meeting in Boston about whether or not this could happen in Boston. And I basically said, yes, it can, and it is more probable than not, because these lines, they're structurally inferior. There are now new kinds of pipes that don't have the same kind of problem. And to leave them in the ground where you have corrosion, where you have potentially these lines have been hit, and under the DOT regulations, the only testing that they're required to do when the line is up is some sort of above-ground tester. That's not going to find those leaks. What you have to do, knowing that you have these leaks, is you have to start uncovering those lines, and you need to start replacing them.
Period.
Period. And you can't wrap them. We had in the Steamboat case, I had another explosion up in Cody, Wyoming, where it got struck, and they wrapped it. Well, that's not going to help you when that fracture occurs.
Right.
And you're going to have an apartment. In that case, an apartment building went up. What's unusual about this is we don't have just this one giant explosion that occurred like in the two cases I've mentioned. You have these multiple explosions that occurred.
That really suggests to me there are large stretches of line that could be a problem.
Absolutely.
It seems to me it's the functional equivalent of like you build like a little housing cul-de-sac. You do it all in 1970 and you put a 25-year roof on it. And, you know, around 1994, one roof fails. Maybe a couple others last another year or two, but they're all going to go around that time.
Even worse, and I like your analogy, but here people's lives are in danger every day. And anybody who lives in that area who understands the truth about it should be very fearful. When is the next explosion going to occur? When are they going to replace these lines? And I'm going to tell you, they had a plan in place back in 2004. But they do talk about how much money it's going to cost them
right.
to replace these lines. And they knowingly delayed it. So we went from 2004 to 2018. And they had plenty of time to fix this so these people would not be going through
God
what they're going through.
God forbid you do that. Now, I mean, it's all about shareholder value, right? Because if we expend more money, where are our profits? We're just eating into profits because right. we're investing in the future. Shareholders want their payoff now. And so this is one of those things.
There's another twist that I want to make sure everybody understands. In Massachusetts, the Public Utilities Commission entered into an agreement with the gas company, and there was a thing in there called the tariff. And in the tariff, they attempted to limit the liability of the gas company for anything like this. And they did it without the consumer's knowledge, without the consumer's knowing, in which it says they're not going to be responsible for anything that occurs with regard to the gas line. And the argument was, well, we're going to keep your gas prices lower that way. All that did was incentivize the company not to do the repairs they needed to do.
Well, if they're not liable, then yeah.
And we believe, because there is some case law in which they've enforced the tariffs in a subrogation case, that the tariff has to be reasonable. And under these circumstances, this company has to be held responsible not only for the damage that it caused, the injuries that it caused,
but also consequential damages, and in this case, it is our opinion, punitive damages.
So, Mike, when do you bring in activists? I mean, you said a jury went to their city council and said that, but, like, this seems to me to be one of those situations where activists would become aware of this tariff and agitate against this and make their lawmakers should be
brought in now. And we're trying, and it's what, one of the reasons I wanted to do this show, and I've been on radio and I've been on television, and I talked to the Boston Globe, is to let these people know that we're out here to help them, not only from the standpoint if you've been injured or displaced, ever you have, you know, you didn't have insurance, but to actually get involved and demand that they go and start digging up this gas system, because, you know, people may not have an idea of when you have a natural gas explosion, the incredible damage that it does. You know, it's worse than a fire, because what happens is when that gas ignites, it'll blow the entire buildings to bits. And one of them that I was involved in, the flames went up almost 100 feet. Jeez. Because that gas is continuing to pour into that mixture, and that fire continues to burn.
Mike Berg, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate being on. Thanks, Sam.
Okay, that was Mike Berg, and we're going to take another break in a minute, and we will hear the interview I did with Bobby Kennedy. Just wanted to give an update on some of the news that I'm seeing in relationship to the Kavanaugh fight. The Super PAC, Priorities USA Action, which is, I don't know if it's the largest Democratic aligned, I guess, Super PAC, but this one says it is threatening Joe Manchin in terms of providing money, and has said it will not back Phil Bredesen in Tennessee over his election with Marsha Blackburn, because he came out and said that he would, in this situation, vote for Kavanaugh. You know, like, but a part of the problem is the American public on some level, right? Like, you know, how much, and good for Priorities USA. But, you know, you can see the implications of what it has with Heitkamp, and it's great for Heitkamp. And I hope that it actually ends up helping her in the end, her stance. But we need to start forced relocation of some folks. So you guys look around the studio. There you go, Matt.
I'll go back when it pays enough. It's gonna be costly, I think.
I think the relocation services is a great idea, Sam. I will volunteer for Omaha. There's a lot of trees there.
Omaha, really?
A lot of good.
You want to be that flat?
I miss the Missouri River Valley, so I could go back out there.
All right, so we're
getting
somewhere.
Start a bike share program, a farmer's market.
I don't know, buddy. You might need to go back to Jersey and make sure that criminal gets reelected.
Hey. Plead the fifth on that one. I used to work for his daughter.
Oh.
All right. Well, there you go. This is like a hotbed of corruption in that studio. all right. We, of course, are not going to hear from Susan Collins for, I guess, another 2 hours.
Leaving
right?
you all in suspense.
But let's take a another quick break. And when we come back, Bobby Kennedy on the recent court case involving Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, as he'll tell us, and an interesting case involving Roundup. Let's go to that now. So joining me now at the Mass Torts 2018 conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, Bobby Kennedy, who is obviously a longtime lawyer with Waterkeeper. And now, are you working with a specific firm on this one?
On
the Monsanto?
On the Roundup.
Yeah.
With Palm Headland. with Baum Hedlund.
Baum Hedlund, okay. And
the California firm.
Okay, and so, all right, tell us about this this Monsanto Roundup litigation, because I think there's, you know, a lot of questions that folks are aware of. New report, I think, out by the Europeans saying that there's reason to believe it is damaging to bees and bee colonies. There's been all sorts of questions about its overuse for, like, environmental issues and creating a monoculture. And then there's also, I think, intellectual property issues involving people having the ability to own their own seeds. What aspect of this have you guys been working on?
Well, we're open to litigate essentially on one aspect, which is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And as you point out, this chemical has a lot of problems with it. And really, the problems have surfaced and the concern has surfaced because of overreaching by Monsanto. Monsanto was recommending Roundup. Roundup is a common name, the brand name for Monsanto's product, glyphosate. And for many years, and it's an herbicide, so it's used by Monsanto. It's used by farmers to kill weeds and avoid paying people to pull the weeds. But Monsanto really made its money. It's now 50% or 75% of the herbicide that's sprayed in America is Roundup. And around the world, it's probably got 80% of the world market. And the way that it got the market is by developing GMO plants that are Roundup resistant. So farmers, rather than individually spraying weeds, can now saturate the entire landscape with Roundup. It kills everything except for that target organism, the GMO, the Roundup Ready corn, the Roundup Ready soy, et cetera, which can grow through the toxic spray. But in 2006, Monsanto developed a new application, or essentially kind of an off-label application for Roundup, which was they started recommending to farmers that if you spray Roundup on crops just before harvest, it dries them out and makes them easier to harvest. So for the first time in history, Roundup was being sprayed not on seedlings, but directly on foods. And so now it's showing up everywhere. It's in milk, it's in mother's milk, it's in our children's cereal, it's in beer, it's in wine, it's in almost all the food, virtually all the corn that you can eat, it's in almost all the wheat. There is no such thing as Roundup Ready wheat. It's used on wheat as a desiccant. And because of that, it's now in all of our foods, and you're seeing this huge explosion of gluten allergies, which everybody is wondering, where did gluten allergies come from? When you and I were kids, there was no such thing as gluten allergies, as far as we knew.
Right.
You know, it was very extremely rare, and today it's painfully common.
All right, well, wait, so let me ask you this. So just so people can follow this, right, there's three aspects to their business. One was to make a crop that allowed for...
Well, their first business, their original business was, this is just a weed killer.
Right. Then they
It was basically sprayed on individual weeds. You couldn't spray it on the corn itself because it would kill the corn too.
So they develop a...
And that was in like 74.
So they develop a corn so that you can completely saturate your field now.
You can
with this
spray
stuff.
It out of airplanes. And
there's, you know, we have, some people have issues with GMO. Let's put those aside for a moment.
Well, GMO, people think, a lot of the people who are concerned with GMO are dismissed because people say, aren't GMOs great because it's a way of making plants more productive.
Right.
But actually, if you look at GMOs, 95% of GMOs in the world are Roundup ready. So they actually increase the use of pesticides in our environment.
Well, that's right. That's what I'm saying. GMOs in and of themselves
The concept, hypothetically, of GMOs is a great concept.
Right.
Because, and it was promised by Monsanto and others, that this is going to reduce the amount of pesticides we need because you're going to be able to develop these new crops where you don't need pesticides.
But what it's actually done is...
has amplified...
The use of it.
Extraordinarily.
And so then they saturate... I'm talking from their business perspective. We've now literally saturated the fields, but we've saturated our business opportunities. So let's take the same product that we're producing and find another use for it so that we can even expand our market even more. So it's not just you don't use it just once when it's a seedling to kill the weeds around it. Now you use it on things and you're not even using it as a pesticide or herbicide, rather. You're using it as some type of like... means in which to make it easier to harvest, which is like sort of the classic. We see this with like drug manufacturers
right,
all the time, right?
Off-label uses.
Yes, we've hit everybody who could use it for blood thinning, so now let's use it for hair loss or something, whatever it is. And so it's on this point that...
it's starting to show up in everybody's foods.
Do we have records of... where it was in terms of its saturation of humans versus where it, now
you know,
where it
I
was.
I don't know that. But I know that it really became an issue in beginning in 2006 because for the first time we're spraying it on foods. And people started measuring at that point and saying it's showing up in our foods. FDA doesn't do that normally in the normal course of business. You know,
And nobody's going into your doctor and saying, 20 years ago, do I have glyphosate?
Nobody's doing that.
Even
the FDA's program for testing foods for herbicides and pesticides is vanishingly small.
Right.
But nobody's really looking for it. And, you know, but now, because of the extraordinary proliferation, everybody's concerned, and we're starting to see disturbing things where we know that it's just the science has passed the inflection point where we know that it causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But there's a lot of other illnesses that we believe are associated with it, and they run the gamut from obesity to Alzheimer's. Liver cancer, non-fatty liver cancer now is exploding, and it's exploding in populations we never saw it before, like in 10-year-old children.
Wow.
Non-alcoholic fatty liver cancer, and we believe there's strong science suggesting that that's coming from glyphosate. Glyphosate is a chelator, which means it removes the metals and minerals. And it does that from plants. And in fact, nowadays, a bushel of corn weighs less than a bushel of corn did 15 years ago. Because the
Even
minerals...
Even if it's the same mass? I mean,
yeah,
I guess,
the same
well,
mass.
It doesn't matter,
because
right?
the minerals, which were the heaviest part of that corn cob... have been chelated out of the corn cob. So the corn's much less, you know, it's not providing you...
the same nutrition.
With nutrition.
Right.
Because the minerals are all gone, but it does that to the human body, too. And it destroys the microbiome, which is one of the most important organs in your body. It controls your mood. It controls your immune system. And it creates inflammation in the brain. A lot of these problems, and these are only a fraction of the problems with glyphosate that people are seeing and that are on the horizon now for this company potentially to have to deal with. One thing that they've got to deal with is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, because in 2016, the International Agency for Cancer Research, which is a global agency, you know, back in the 1970s or 80s, the governments got together and said, you know, none of us have the ability to and the resources to determine what, you know, what is a carcinogen and what isn't. And we really need an esteemed international group that is going to create those designations. So they created this group, and really it's a system. It's not a static group. They take the best cancer scientists in the world, independent scientists who don't have industry ties, and they bring them together on panels every year. And the panels look at specific compounds. So they'll look at benzene or specific molecules. So they'll look at benzene one year. They'll look at cigarette smoking and says, does that cause cancer? They'll look at certain occupations, like do people who do who work in the steel mills get cancer?
They're assessing statistics primarily.
And there's a number. It's very unusual because most countries you can't incorporate an outside finding in a statute, but countries all over the world, because IARC is so respected, will say anything designated by IARC as carcinogen will be treated as a carcinogen under our laws. So, for example, the state of California has Prop 65 that says if there's a carcinogen, you have to label it if it's it before you put it into the stream of commerce. And they say, and that law says, for the purpose of determining what is a carcinogen, what isn't a carcinogen,
use IARC.
We rely on IARC. So if IARC says something's a carcinogen, there are 30 countries and 35 states that say, under their laws, it is treated as a carcinogen legally. And so IARC designated glyphosate a probable carcinogen for humans and a definite carcinogen for animals, and that triggered a cascade of new developments, of legal developments. It triggered, for example, all of these attorneys who suddenly began filing lawsuits on behalf of clients who had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma after exposures to glyphosate. And now today there are about, well, when we filed this case, there was about 4,000 of those losses. Now there's about 9,000.
Wow.
And
have these been brought together in like some type of MDL?
All the attorneys are working together. They're coordinating strategies. The first case that went to trial was Dwayne Lee Johnson, who was a school groundskeeper in California, in Northern California, and he had been spraying Roundup for 2 years, and in a way that actually covered his body with Roundup. He was spraying huge amounts to kill the weeds on the school property, and he was very careful with it. The equipment that he had was malfunctioned a lot, and even though he would wear like a moon suit, Tyvek suit, he was getting saturated. And as it turned out, the Tyvek suit would trap the glyphosate inside his suit. And because he was sweating, it would actually penetrate his body much more effectively. And that's what the experts testified. And he got a very debilitating form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that is fatal. His doctors say that he has now less than a year to live. But it disfigured him a lot. His skin was, really, really disturbing looking. He was also a very good client. He's a wonderful man, and he has a very, very good presentation. He's very hardworking. He has a great family. He fell in love when he was in college, love at first sight, with a woman who had immigrated here from Mexico. They have two kids, and the wife testified, Araceli, and he testified, and I think the jury really fell in love with them, and so it was a good case. And, you know, we ended up getting a $290 million verdict, $40 million for pain and suffering and compensatory damages, and then about $250 million for punitive damages in one case. And now Monsanto at that time was facing 4,000 other cases, but, you know, and as we predicted, they should have settled. The victory in that case has alerted other people that, you know, this
is... It set some type of parameters.
Right.
So now, is this case being
appealed? And so now there's close to 9,000 cases.
Now, does Monsanto appeal this first case? They must.
Yeah, they're going to appeal, and they're going to... They've already filed a number of appeals, but the first appeal is that the judge has the ability to reduce or to even to eliminate that jury judgment. I think it's going to be hard for her to do, even though she was not friendly to our case throughout the trial. But we picked a jury. There were 35 people excluded from the jury because they expressed some negative attitudes towards Monsanto, which is extraordinary in itself.
Right.
35 people. The jurors who were left over expressed no negativity toward Monsanto. It was a highly educated jury. Everybody on it had a college education. There were two working scientists on the jury. The level of attention, one of the jurors filled 5 notebooks with notes. All of the jurors took notes throughout the trial. They were all alert, and they asked extraordinarily detailed questions about specific rat studies and specific rats in those rat studies. So they were very, very well informed. And it would be, and the jury, you know, the verdict was a rational one. It would be kind of a slap in the face of the American jury system if the judge went and meddled with that verdict after these people gave 2 months of their lives.
Right.
You know, to come in and gave all that attention. You know,
what do you guys anticipate Monsanto does? They come out, they claim they're going to appeal.
The thing is that it's no longer Monsanto, it's Bayer, because Bayer, which is a German pharmaceutical company, and, you know, Bayer was the company that was a big supporter of Hitler's. It was, it was called IG Farben at that time, and it made the Zyklon B gas that was used to exterminate Jews at Auschwitz, and it has a long history, but it's a huge chemical conglomerate now and pharmaceutical conglomerate. They purchased Monsanto for $66 billion in June.
Wow.
And right before this verdict came down, and their stock had dropped 18%, and then it regained 4%, so it's the permanent injury from that lawsuit, from that verdict, is about 14%, which is billions and billions of dollars. And, I think Bayer, it looks like they did not do a due diligence on Monsanto, and their stockholders have a lot of reason to be angry at them. And now, because Monsanto had, when it negotiated its takeover with Bayer, said to Bayer, don't worry, we've put aside $250 million to deal with these lawsuits. So
turns
that
out,
and all that money is gone.
All right, well, let me ask you this. In the context of the original case, and presumably Bayer will appeal, and maybe they will prevail, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll negotiate. If there's at least 4,000 to 9,000 cases out there, they know they're going to have to go through this again. So they're probably sitting there trying to figure out some type of algorithm, like how much is this going to cost us? Like, if we wanted this to go away, or maybe they'll just say we're just going to keep fighting this for eternity. It's just going to be one of our divisions is going to be protecting Bayer. Some law is going to be a law firm made by a law firm. But in the original case, what was the was the case centered on the fact that Monsanto must have known that their secondary spraying, that their new off-label use of glyphosate would lead to this?
Monsanto knew from the 70s that there was a lot of problems with, in fact, their original rat studies when they were trying to get licensed. Their original rat studies showed that the rats all got tumors. And Monsanto was able to strong-arm EPA, as it turned out, Monsanto had a mole in the EPA's pesticide division who rose up and at the end was running the division. His name was Jess Rowland. And he was doing favors for Monsanto to block studies, to kill studies. And we got all those documents. So at one point, he's telling his Monsanto handler, if I can kill this study by another agency, you need to give me a medal. And then he goes out and he succeeds in killing it. So we had all these documents showing that Monsanto knew that it was carcinogenic or had reason to believe that and was killing the studies one after the other. And, that's one of the things the jury saw. And that's why they got punitive damages, because it was a knowing deception. Not only that, Monsanto not only successfully blocked, they were ghostwriting studies, they were bribing scientists, they had captured the regulatory agency. They had their own guy running the pesticide division in EPA, and we have proof of that. They were also, the thing they really were concerned about is they did not want any testing done on the whole compound. So they would allow testing on glyphosate, but they actually had things in the compound
that
appear to be much more dangerous than glyphosate.
And probably the interaction of those.
They're called adjuvants.
Okay.
And those are the molecules that allowed glyphosate to penetrate the bark of the plant. They do the same thing with humans. If you get it, what the science indicates is that the worst thing that you can do with Roundup is to spray it. It's probably worse than eating the glyphosate because of the capacity of these surfactants or adjuvants to penetrate your body and, very, very efficiently. And then, to cross all the internal barriers, including a blood-brain barrier in your body. So the stuff is really, the compound itself has not been tested. And we have all kinds of documents in which they're saying, we got to make sure that nobody tests the entire compound.
Wow. All right. Well, Bobby Kennedy, thank you for updating us.
Sam, really good to see you again. It's really good to see you. Great being back at Ring of Fire.
Well, yes, I appreciate that. All right, Bobby Kennedy, folks, and we'll take a quick break. Be right back with more from Mass Torts 2018.
So that's Bobby Kennedy, and we will head into the fun half. It's now 1:35 Eastern Time. It is, I don't know what time it is here, 10:30 maybe. And we will hear from Susan Collins in about 90 minutes or so. And I got to say, opportunity to hear from you guys on the free show. It's just hard for me to believe that Susan Collins is going to make such a production of voting yes, of doing the sort of brave vote, right? I mean, I don't think that's just my perspective. I think objectively speaking, for her to vote against, for any person to vote against their party, maybe brave is not the right word. It is more controversial than voting with your party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why you would want that. On the other hand, she comes out today at 3 and says she is voting for Kavanaugh. It takes the pressure off of Manchin to vote for Kavanaugh on some level. Because if she votes for Kavanaugh, then Mike Pence ends up being the then it's a done deal anyways. So his vote is sort of irrelevant tomorrow. But I guess we will see. I mean, I have just successfully convinced myself that she will vote against Kavanaugh and successfully convinced myself that she will vote for Kavanaugh's confirmation.
I'm playing chess against myself.
And it's a total stalemate. But, I mean, those are the two, you know, those are the two reasonings as to why you would see her announce at 3 p.m.
I think she's going to vote against. Maybe. I don't know why. I just... No, I mean, actually, I think it's just... I think that if she was going to vote for him, she would just do it, get it over with, and announce it, and sort of end the drama. I don't see the advantage for prolonged drama in a yes vote for her.
Well, the advantage is she gets to say, oh, there was an investigation and they didn't find anything.
No, but I'm saying she should have done that yesterday.
Oh, well, yeah.
Then it would be like, yeah, when she said it was thorough, then she could have just been like, all right, here I am.
Could be right. I mean,
of pressure on her. I mean, what's the advantage of that?
Well, I mean, 3 p.m. is, you know, the... another day of pressure, but now she is guaranteed a platform in which to justify her vote.
Mm. Yeah, she'll right? look like I mean, she did her due diligence. Mm.
But, you know, who is she justifying her vote for?
Right.
I haven't seen what the Kavanaugh numbers are in Maine, but if they are even remotely close to what the rest of the country in more less Trump, you know, Trump-ful states, the numbers have to be running against Kavanaugh, I would imagine, in Maine. That would be my guess. So, you know, maybe I just, who is she trying to justify a yes vote to? I mean, a no vote to. I guess, you know, we'll see. I don't know.
Right.
That's the long and short of it. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song? Maybe
yes.
The insight lies in Jimmy Reefer Cake, who is, in fact, a maniac himself, a Maine citizen.
It might be in the song because it's called The Dankest Truth from Outer Space.
The Dankest Truth from Out of Space. Okay. Well, let's hear that song. Oh, before we do, folks, just a reminder, jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support makes this show possible. This past week, we had a Tuesday. Tuesday existed this week. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. As I was saying, this week did include a Tuesday, which means that it included a Tuesday night, which means that it included a Michael Brooks show. In fact, not just a Michael Brooks show, but the Michael Brooks show. Michael, who was on that show?
Daniel Bessner, who is author of Democracy in Exile, Rise of the Defense Intellectual, and author of a recent op-ed in the New York Times on a left foreign policy, like what that would actually look like programmatically. We talked about the European Union. We talked about China and Africa. We talked about why the concept of national security, just like the economy, is sort of a myth, and how to actually disaggregate what we're actually talking about. It was great, and we took a lot of questions in the post game on the mechanics of how a left-wing foreign policy actually comes together, and also, of course, touched on what's going on in Brazil, which Daniel just got back from. Patreon.com/TMBS. Next Tuesday, Alex Perrine.
Jamie, the Antifada.
Yeah, so this week we had on artist and journalist Molly Crabapple. That episode is out now. We talked about DIY disaster relief and mutual aid and austerity resistance in Puerto Rico. We also talked a little bit about how our sex worker comrades are resisting Sesta Fosta and fighting for safety and dignity. We also looked back a little bit on our own time in the naked girl business, which is actually how me and Molly know each other. Also, Sean reminded me that our patron goal bonus is out now. That is the first and possibly only episode of our cooking show, Acid Kitchen. So check it out, folks, for your psycho culinary delight. It's for patrons.
And Matt, literary hangover this week?
Yeah, there's going to be a brand new one out this weekend on Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind, where we will apply Corey Robbins' book to the zero-sum debate that Majority Report had. There's a very relevant portion of that book, and I'm not going to spoil anything. Check it out this weekend if you want to hear about that.
It's a zero-sum game.
All right, let's hear the Jimmy Reefer Cake offering for the week.
Rocking out.
Wow, that was really a throwback.
That was like at your time when you were not knowing who Ace of Base was.
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff.
We got to get that song to Susan Collins. We'll speak to her conscience.
Exactly. Dankest outer space will melt your face.
The dankest truth.
Just also one thing to look out for, the trial of Jason Van Dyke, who is the cop who shot Laquan McDonald in Chicago. Folks recall that video from now a year and a half ago, maybe. That my understanding is that the verdict is supposed to come down really any minute, and it could be a real mess in Chicago. So keep an eye on that. In the meantime, we will take a break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. We will take your calls and your IMs. See you in a moment.